From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. We're here today with Greg Scarlatu, Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, to talk about the recent floods in the northeastern part of the DPRK. The Red Cross recently said that up to 600,000 people could be affected by these floods, so this is a pretty big deal in North Korea right now. But of course, we have the backdrop of North Korea's recent provocations, including the fifth nuclear test in September. So there's a lot of issues that we're going to have to be dealing with that are related to these floods and to the humanitarian crisis going on right now. So Greg, thank you so much for joining us and for providing your insights here.
Jenna, good to see you again. The pleasure is all mine, as always. I hope one of these days we'll have a chance to discuss a happier topic as well.
Right, I hope so too. But to get into this unfortunate situation with the flooding, do you mind starting us off with kind of a general idea of what's going on? What happened? Do you think that the Red Cross is about right in their estimate, about 600,000 people being affected?
What we know is that according to the North Korean authorities, basically this appears to be the worst flooding since 1945. UN agencies operating inside North Korea, together with representatives of NGOs that are active inside North Korea working on humanitarian assistance programs, participated in a fact-finding mission led by the North Korean government from September the 6th to September the 9th. Of course, what we also know is that on September the 9th, North Korea proceeded with its fifth nuclear test, even under those circumstances. It seems that UN agencies agree that the situation is rather dire. It seems that they have launched several appeals for funding, and it also appears that the available funding is insufficient for a variety of reasons, and one might say for a variety of good reasons.
So I'll have you elaborate on that. I know that, for example, the South Korean government has said that they won't provide aid in this particular case, and with sanctions being tightened earlier this year and then calls for even tighter sanctions after the fifth nuclear test, how do these things play out when it comes to helping people in this situation?
What we know for sure about the sanctions regime is that the sanctions, first and foremost sanctions based on UN Security Council resolutions, have two goals. One is to prevent the development and proliferation of missile technology and nuclear weapons by North Korea. The second goal is to punish the elites in charge of that development and proliferation by severing their access to luxury goods imported from overseas. One terrible thing about the sanctions regime based on UN Security Council resolutions is that it has nothing, but absolutely nothing to do with North Korea's abysmal human rights violations or crimes against humanity. However, here in the United States, a few months ago, we passed the North Korea Policy and Sanctions Enforcement Act, which clearly includes human rights violations in the type of behavior that's subjected to the sanctions. Those who drafted this act went to great lengths to ensure that a humanitarian exception is included. UN Security Council resolutions do not target the people of North Korea. Sanctions implemented pursuant to our own US legislation do not target the people of North Korea. Moreover, they provide for exceptions in the case of humanitarian assistance. But, of course, there are many other issues here that come into play. And here I'm not talking about emergency humanitarian assistance. Here I'm talking about the humanitarian assistance disbursed to North Korea for the past 20 years. About 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, in the mid-1990s, as we all know, North Korea experienced a great famine. The international community did help. There were significant amounts of aid being sent into North Korea. Back then, of course, there were serious concerns about the lack of transparency, the lack of adequate monitoring, and there were very serious concerns about the North Korean regime actually diverting precious aid and resources to those areas where it needed it in order to maintain itself in power, for example, the elites or the North Korean military. Now, 20 years later, if you're talking regular humanitarian assistance, you begin to see donor fatigue developing. Why is that? It's very difficult if you're an NGO tasked to disperse humanitarian assistance inside North Korea. It's very difficult to go back to your donors year after year after year and tell them that there are still humanitarian needs in North Korea. This is not a country that's in a state of civil war. This is not a failed state. As a matter of fact, the North Korean regime still maintains a very firm grip on its people. It has the capacity to exercise ruthless coercion, control, surveillance, and punishment of its citizens. This was not a country that experienced any major natural disasters since the Great Famine, so it's simply very difficult to persuade donors. However, that said, if you are faced with a natural disaster, it's politically more expedient to disburse humanitarian assistance. What does that mean? In the case of the United States, for example, the last time we had a bilateral humanitarian assistance program extended to the North Koreans was 2008-2009. Back then, 500,000 metric tons of food were disbursed through USAID, 400,000 through the World Food Program, 100,000 through a consortium of five NGOs. There were some successes of that program. A letter of understanding was negotiated. There were some good lessons learned. But unfortunately, at the end of the day, the North Korean government refused to conduct a nutritional survey that was part of the scope of work of the program, and asked the five NGOs to pull up stakes and leave. There is a widespread misperception and misconception that the program was terminated because of North Korea's nuclear and missile developments. It is not true. The program was terminated by the North Koreans because they refused to apply with internationally accepted standards of project monitoring. So this is the problem we have continued to face in North Korea. But again, if you're talking about American assistance, this is Public Law 480 assistance, PL 480 assistance. When you make a decision related to such assistance, it's based on two major considerations: need and urgency. Are North Korean people in need? Yes. Is there more of an emergency than there is, let's say, for example, in the South Sudan or Syria or other places? Based on this, you make the decision. Theoretically, it shouldn't be political. But in the real world, it's really difficult. While the North Koreans are focusing and concentrating and expending so many resources on ballistic missiles and nukes aimed eventually at the United States, it's very difficult to get this through. Granted, after a natural disaster, everyone generally agrees, even those in a position to make these decisions, that, okay, yes, the situation is dire, but, well, this time around, what can we do about it? Let it go. But the situation is so tense, and the North Korean regime has basically pushed these programs so far that it almost looks like they've crossed the bridge of no return. And it has become very, very difficult to approve and disburse any type of humanitarian assistance to North Korea, whether it's post-disaster assistance or not.
Yeah, so I want to pick up on something you said at the end there, because I've been reading a lot about this back and forth, this argument, not just necessarily in the case of the flooding, but it's a kind of broader ethical issue. Number one, whether providing assistance actually gets to the people that you are assisting. And I'm curious, in your experience or your expertise, what you think about that argument. And then secondly, not just necessarily the fact that your assistance may or may not be supporting the regime, but also the fact that the regime is using its resources not to help its own people, but, as you say, to develop these nuclear and ballistic weapons. And so the question becomes, why should we be helping this regime when they're not helping their own people? Why should we continue to, provide assistance to people when that should be the government's job and they're using it for other nefarious means? I've been hearing this argument a lot, and I'm very curious to hear your take. How would you respond to these concerns?
What we know about the nature of the Kim regime in North Korea is that its utmost and ultimate strategic objective is its own survival. The Kim regime does not want its own people to die by the millions. But if, in order to maintain itself in power, it has to sacrifice them by the millions, it will, in the blink of an eye. So when resources are insufficient, I've heard this comparison being made to an organism, a body experiencing hypothermia. Insufficient resources are first directed toward the very core of the regime, toward the heart. Of course, resources go first to the regime, the elites, those who are needed in order to maintain the regime in power, whether that's the military or certain units in the military. That's how the regime operates. So there is no doubt that the lack of transparency, the lack of adequate monitoring is a deliberate policy. To us, transparency and monitoring are simply a matter of good practices. That's how we run programs. The money comes from somewhere. If it's taxpayers' money, you must be accountable. If you're a nonprofit and it's private donors' money, again, you're accountable. That's how we run programs. That said, about the actual implementation of humanitarian assistance to North Korea, you will hear stories and estimates across a broad range. And let me talk about the extremes. At one end of the range, you will hear, actually, despite the difficulties, and everyone is aware of the difficulties, we have been making good progress, we have success stories, we're helping people, and there is no diversion happening. Basically, we proceed with these programs unhampered, more or less, despite having to navigate a very difficult environment. At the other end of the spectrum, you'll hear people and organizations saying none of this assistance reaching anyone in need in North Korea. None of this humanitarian assistance reaches anyone who needs it. It's all diverted by the government. So where is the truth? I mean, every now and then the truth might be close to one of these two extremes, but generally, the truth, of course, is somewhere in between. It may be true, for example, that North Korean defectors from a certain province of North Korea tell you, I've never seen any UN, USAID assistance, none whatsoever. And that may be true. But you also have to ask the next question. Has humanitarian assistance ever been disbursed to that particular area of North Korea? Another classic story. You see pictures of bags of rice, USAID, a gift from the American people, printed all over the bags of rice. You know, you have revelation. You realize, aha, there is the aha moment. The humanitarian assistance was not disbursed to those who needed most. It was instead sold at the markets. Did that happen? Perhaps. But you might talk to experts who will tell you, no, actually the story might be different. Containers are very precious in North Korea, so people keep and recycle the containers. So perhaps the USAID rice was consumed, and now it's just the container, the bag, that is being used. Because North Korea is such a tightly closed environment, because access is so limited, it is very difficult to think in absolutes. But I think that any organization involved with North Korea, whether it's a human rights organization, whether it's a humanitarian organization involved in work inside North Korea, whether it's a UN agency, I think we will all agree, at least behind closed doors, that this regime is only keen on its own survival, does not operate like normal governments in the normal world. It will have no qualms about sacrificing its own people by the hundreds of thousands and millions. By the way, it has done it already. It did it 20 years ago. And then we will all agree that it is an extraordinarily tough environment that lacks transparency, adequate monitoring, very difficult to operate in.
So we've had this kind of conversation. I know I've talked to you about this before, perhaps in our last podcast even. But one thing that I'm always interested in is public perceptions here in the U.S. about North Korea and the fact that I don't know if the average person on the street would know there was a flood in North Korea and that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people need assistance. And I guess my question here is, given that pretty much what the mainstream news covers, at least here in the U.S., is nuclear tests and some extreme situations like that, how do we get the word out, or how do we talk about things like humanitarian assistance when people don't really know anything about it, or are maybe skeptical of it, or are worried about it going to the regime? How do we, you know, talk about humanitarian assistance and get the public to understand that there's a need here?
This will continue to be a daunting task. It applies not only to post-natural disaster humanitarian assistance in North Korea, but also to a variety of human rights issues, for example. There is still an ongoing slow-motion North Korean refugee crisis. It's very serious. But we are competing in terms of gaining international attention against cataclysmic situations elsewhere in the world, which are very, very visible due to the chaos that has overwhelmed the Middle East. There is an overwhelming refugee crisis in the Mediterranean basin. There is a very serious refugee crisis in South Asia. It is always a challenge to maintain North Korea on the radar screen. Speaking of natural disasters and flooding, I'm not sure when you will publish this interview, Jenna, but as we speak today, there is a major hurricane that has just made landfall in the Caribbean. And here in the United States, all along the East Coast, we're bracing ourselves for the worst. I think that this is a clear example of how difficult it can be to keep North Korea on the radar screen while dealing with our own issues here at home.
Yeah, it continues to be a major issue, not just, as you said, the humanitarian issues, but human rights in general, North Korea in general. I mean, policy as well as human rights sometimes, unfortunately, gets put on the back burner. But these are the questions I wanted to ask you. I do want to give you a time, if you have anything else you think it's important for our listeners to know about the flooding or about the human rights situation in North Korea right now. Is there anything that you would like to say?
Yes. As news of the flooding in North Korea was being delivered by international media organizations, of course, we thought of the focus of one of our areas of research, which is North Korea's detention facilities. Through the use of satellite imagery and satellite imagery analysis, we have developed a baseline of all political prison camps in North Korea. And we had just begun actually developing a baseline for re-education labor camps. It so happened that in early September, we had published a baseline report on re-education forced labor camp number 12 in Cheonggori, North Hamgyong province. This is close to the border with China, also in the midst of the worst of the flooding. Due to the cloud cover, we were unable to acquire good satellite images of other facilities, but we were able to acquire satellite images of this particular facility that indicated extensive flood damage. We issued a rapid assessment based on the satellite imagery analysis and the press release that was shared with many, including UN agencies. Why am I bringing up the UN? Because for a couple of years now, we have been advocating for a human rights upfront approach at the United Nations. This is actually an initiative advanced by the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, in the aftermath of the final days of the Sri Lankan war and the humanitarian crisis that happened back then. The whole idea, to put it very simply, we could be doing a series of podcasts on this topic. The idea is that if a humanitarian agency is involved in dispersing humanitarian assistance, they should be cognizant of human rights findings of the human rights situation, and they should apply that knowledge they have of the human rights situation to their work. What does it mean? A simple example in the case of North Korea. The World Health Organization is one of the UN agencies that have been involved in North Korea. They have a very good program implemented throughout the developing world. It's called Health in Prisons. Our suggestion, to put it very simply, why not seek access to those in detention in North Korea and try to apply such a program to various detention facilities in North Korea? Yes, the North Korean regime adamantly refuses to admit to the existence of political prison camps, although we have witnesses, testimony, satellite imagery, but they have directly or indirectly admitted to the existence of re-education labor camps. It's in their penal code, it's in their legislation. Here, in Cheonggori, we are talking about a re-education labor camp. So our message to the UN was simple. If the United Nations is considering post-disaster humanitarian assistance to North Korea, please find a way to inspect these facilities, conduct fact-finding missions, and because the individuals imprisoned at these facilities are amongst the most vulnerable in North Korea. Their food insecurity is dire, and due to the flooding, access may have been even more severely limited, access to these facilities. Please find a way to include them in the fact-finding missions that you're conducting. And I am pleased to report that while I cannot get into details, we had very good communication with senior officials at the United Nations. They were very receptive. Of course, they were aware of these efforts. And most importantly, Mr. Tomas Ohea Quintana, the new UN Special Rapporteur on the North Korean human rights situation, issued a statement on the flooding, drawing attention to the importance of helping those who need assistance the most. But for the first time ever, he urged the North Korean government, the government of the DPRK, to grant access to those in detention. No one will claim that UN action is a silver bullet, but this is a very important point of access, and it's extraordinarily important that senior UN officials now see the connection between human rights concerns and humanitarian concerns in North Korea. We will seizing on this opportunity to draw attention to the human rights upfront approach. We will continue with our efforts to advocate for a human rights upfront approach in North Korea. The bottom line in North Korea is that, once again, this is a government, this is a regime that surely has the resources to develop a nuclear program, a long-range ballistic missile program, It focuses resources on developing weapons, while at the same time it invests close to nothing in preparing for disaster assistance. There is little, if any, disaster preparedness, and there is little, if any, amount spent on the health security, the food security, the economic security of the people of North Korea, having been born and raised in a totalitarian communist country, Romania, that was most similar to Kim Il-sung's North Korea. It was the North Korea of Eastern Europe. I remember the year 1977. There was a great earthquake on the 4th of March, 1977. The dictator of Romania, Nicolae Ceausescu, terrible, terrible, terrible character. He ended up being brought before a firing squad in 1989. He was overseas during the great earthquake. He came back home immediately and visited the disaster areas. Kim Jong-un has not yet visited the flooded area. And I think that's all we have to know about how much the North Korean regime cares about its own people.
Unfortunately, a sobering topic that we end up talking about, but I hope that, as you mentioned at the beginning, that we have at some point some silver linings to talk about as well. So thank you for all your efforts when it comes to human rights in North Korea, and thank you for your time and your expertise here today.
And thank you, Jenna and KEI.
As always, thanks very much for joining us for this episode of Korean Context. If you haven't already subscribed to our podcast, you can do so on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also leave us a review if you like what you hear. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back next week with another episode.